It's officially DC festival season, and we're super excited about this one coming up on May 18th. Africa on the Avenue is a celebration of the vibrant African immigrant community along Georgia Avenue Northwest. There's going to be interactive art installations, fashion shows, music, food, and local business stands. This one-day festival, organized by District Bridges' Lower Georgia Avenue Main Street program, truly has something for everyone. So I'll see you there on May 18th. Go to districtbridges.org to learn more.
Today on CityCast DC, we are talking about what the DC budget means for the cost of your childcare. And we're talking about what the Virginia budget means for the health of our metro system. And we're also, because we have some fun here too, talking about ways you can vote for DC's best restaurants. I'm joined by Michael Pope and Brianna Thomas. Stick around. Today is Friday, April 12th. I'm Michael Schaefer, and here's what DC is talking about. Hey, Michael. Hey, Brianna.
Hey there. How are you?
I'm all right.
Hey.
Good to see you again, Brianna.
Happy to be back.
Before we begin, I want to do a shout out to member Philip Moss, who won a Hey DC mug. Thanks for helping us do what we do. And if you are interested in winning cool things like tickets to the Washington Nationals, which, sorry, Phil, that sounds better to me than a mug, we have two pairs of FIS Champions Club tickets to see them whenever you want this season. All you have to do is become a member by April 19th. To do that, head to membership.citycast.fm and pick a tier that works for you. In addition to winning Nats tickets, you'll get ad-free podcast listening, exclusive members-only updates, and you'll be the first to know about our future events. Again, head to membership.citycast.fm. Thank you. All right, so I want to talk, you guys, about daycare, which my kids have happily aged out, but I think anyone who's got young kids knows this is like the most stressful thing, like finding one, paying for one, navigating the wait lists of them. And, you know, for years, it's also been like a pretty unjust industry. I mean, you've got workers, a lot of them making very close to minimum wage. At the same time, DC and a bunch of other places have required daycare workers to like get associates or bachelor's degrees because we view this as important. Just we don't view paying them as important. And one of the things DC did in the last few years that was pretty novel and made, I think, a difference is it created this fund based from a new tax on wealthy people that was called an equity fund. But basically, it supplemented the pay of daycare teachers so that they could, you know, afford to live in this pretty expensive place. You know, it's not added an enormous number of people to the system, but it's added some, and every little bit helps because, you know, it's one of these weird things where, like, even people who are like, I have the money to pay for daycare can't always find a space, and bringing more workers in would presumably help that. That fund is now on the chopping block in the DC budget because DC has a whole lot of deficit and needs to find a way to fix it. It's going to be, I suspect, I mean, it already is the, like, emotional hot button of this budget cycle among the things that are cuts, and it's going to be, you know, a tough thing. Nobody kind of wants to own the, I mean, the mayor is the one who's proposed to cut it, and she's said she's doing it with great regret and so on. There's an effort in the council to restore it, but it's sort of an interesting politics because on the face of it, it looks like, oh, this is, you know, a program aimed at lower income workers. But I think the actual impact of, you know, if people were to say, you know, I can't afford to be a daycare teacher, I'm going to go work for the post office or something, which like literally a bunch of people did, that actually is going to hurt a lot of people, some of them like pretty rich and with some power.
Yeah. And they're doing this at a time when, you know, it's really difficult to be a child and to grow up. You know, I mean, like you were mentioning that this is sort of like a long-term problem, getting people to work in this industry. So that's kind of something that hasn't changed, but something that has changed is the environment that these children are growing up in. I was struck by the quote in the Washington Post from the longtime childcare worker who said, children are coming in with real trauma. They're coming in more aggressive. They're coming in with less language. They've been exposed to a lot of screen time and they have short attention spans. So there's layers here. I mean, there's this existing problem of childcare and how the industry works. And you're right, it is kind of shady. And then layered on top of that is the world that we live in.
I don't have kids yet, but my sister, she's a 10 plus year DCPS school teacher. And these educators work really, really hard. I mean, it's one thing to know the all the work, you know, and challenges that come with being a parent, dealing with your own child at home. But I think having to think about that struggle and then telling someone we're going to cut your support for funding, but we still want you to take care of these children with the same care and the same, you know, attention and nurture. It's almost like a slap in the face. It just doesn't feel right.
Right. So, you know, you could say, well, if it's a hard job and become harder, then the employers should just pay them more. But that cost, of course, gets passed on to parents, a lot of whom are struggling to pay even the current cost of childcare, which is not, you know, it is not public school. Now, DCPS now offers pre-K 3, so you don't have to spend as many years in childcare, but you got to spend some if it's a family where all the parents or the single parent is working. I mean, this is like from a politics point of view, right? Like no one wants anything to ever be cut. But this seems like one where I can imagine more than the usual constituencies opposing the cut. Where do y'all see the politics of this going?
I think from a political standpoint, I was taken by the way you described the equity fund, right? So you take money from rich people to spread the wealth a little bit. I mean, that sounds like the politics of that would be popular, maybe even populist. I'm wondering, what are they going to do with this money if they don't use it for this? I mean, are they just going to go into the general fund to help balance the budget because they got to slash $500 million to give it to the rich guy so he can have an arena?
The challenge they've got is they've got a chief financial officer, which under the DC system is a sort of the mayor appoints him and the council okays it. But at that point, you can't just fire this person. The person to certify the budget, who is saying they need to replenish their rainy day fund. And he's saying it's not crazy pants. It's, look, you guys, we're looking at revenues flat. A lot of the COVID money is gone away. Around about 2027, you may have trouble paying your bills. You need to have this fund replenished. The administration didn't expect that. So this sort of threw a curveball to them. So they've got to find more savings. You know, the recriminations are more like, hey, people who proposed things that were maybe unnecessary spending a couple of years ago, they ought to own the fact that this like rotten choice has to get made. What I think of it is, yes, it was taking money from a new tax on the wealthy to fund this thing. But in a weird way, the benefits went beyond just the daycare teachers to daycare consumers, which is a group that includes some wealthy people. And it's not that those people can't afford to pay. It's that oftentimes, you know, you're looking to get yourself a spot in daycare and there just isn't one. You're on a wait list for a couple of years, which makes me think it's like, I mean, weirdly, the term equity fund, you know, it kind of, at least to my ear, rings in a sort of altruistic woo-woo sort of way that is like, you know, at the time when it's like, we must make hard choices about the budget, it's easy for some people to convince themselves they need to whack things like that. But in fact, this is one type of equity where the benefits are not just felt by the people who've been on the outside before.
Yeah, well, you're taking money from the wealthy to give it to these low-income workers. So that's the kind of equity sharing the wealth part of it. But I take your point, which is a good one, which is what about the end consumer of the services that are being offered by the people who get the bump in pay? Those could be very wealthy people too, right?
So I mean they're kind of everybody, right? Because there is no public school at that age group.
Everybody knows that getting that perfect Mother's Day gift is basically impossible, but we promise Mom will love this one. The Capitol Hill Restoration Society House and Garden Tour is back this Mother's Day weekend on May 11th and May 12th. Tour 9 elaborate homes and gardens and 3 historic buildings on Capitol Hill that you can't normally enter. And if you can't make it, check out the Capitol Hill Restoration Society's other events like walking tours and monthly preservation cafes. You can buy tickets for the Mother's Day House and Garden Tour on Eventbrite, and be sure to follow CHRS on Facebook and Instagram at Capitol Hill Restoration DC.
So speaking of like things where everybody benefits, but not everybody necessarily pays or wants to pay, there's a thing you've been covering in Virginia, your bailiwick, where the governor, Glenn Youngkin, fresh off his non-success at creating an urban destination for the Capitals and Wizards, which was going to be reliant on Metro, has now kind of at last minute switcheroo threatened Metro funding in the Virginia budget. What, like, can you explain, and this is the needle you got to thread, is like, explain this without getting too wonky on us. Like, what's he done, and like, what does it possibly mean for riders of the system?
Well, for riders of the system, it could mean that there's essentially less money to go around. So, I mean, the end result of this might be that the new metro entrances that we were expecting in Virginia at Ballston and Crystal City, those new entrances might be scrapped or delayed. So essentially what's going on here is that the governor has the ability to make a budget amendment. So the General Assembly sent him a budget. The governor gets to make as many amendments as he wants to. And he made a lot of them, a historic number of budget amendments in this cycle. But it's important for your listeners to know that this is not over yet. This is one step in the process. It does not mean this is happening. The General Assembly gets to convene next week. They're going to have what they call a reconvene session and vote on all these budget amendments. And Democrats are in control of the House and Democrats are in control of the Senate. And all you need is a majority to get rid of these budget amendments. So I would expect most of these budget amendments to be voted down, including this Metro one that we're talking about. So this might actually be an academic discussion. But what the governor has done here with his budget amendment is reduce the fund. So the General Assembly wanted to pay $150 million. The governor reduced that to $130 million. Okay, so you might say $130 million sounds like a lot of money. What's the problem with that? The problem is that only a very small part of that actually comes from the state, $35 million. So he's shifting the burden to Northern Virginia, specifically the Northern Virginia Transportation Commission, which has a huge pot of other stuff that they want to spend that money on, like these new entrances to metro stations at Ballston and Crystal City. So by shifting the burden, it means that the guy who heads the Northern Virginia Transportation Commission, who's a member of the Arlington County Board, Matt DeFerenti, he has some hard choices to make. So it used to be, you know, the under the previous model, the metro system was getting a good chunk of change here from Virginia, basically the same amount of money that Maryland was going to kick in. But now there's a smaller amount of money and the burden has shifted to Northern Virginia. There is a sense in Richmond among the elected officials that what we're really dealing with here is some hurt feelings about the arena that did not happen. So the governor obviously wanted the arena to happen. It was a failure. And now there is this belief that he wants to start punishing people, especially people in Northern Virginia who helped kill the deal.
Wait. Isn't the Louise Lucas, who's, you know, the one most associated with killing the deal, she is not from Northern Virginia.
Well, he also killed a lot of her bills, too, like including she was a major proponent of something called skill games, which are the machines that sort of look like slot machines that are in convenience stores. Supposedly, if you have a skill, you can win at the game. So they're not, it's not dumb luck the way a slot machine is. But anyway, the reason I bring this up is Louise Lucas was one of the biggest supporters of having these skill games in convenience stores and truck stops. And he put an amendment on it that mostly killed that bill. So he is definitely exacting, you know, I mean, one way to perceive these budget amendments is he's exacting revenge on people who wronged him in the arena deal.
But so, can you just sort of more broadly explain the politics in Virginia of this? Because, you know, if he's having a hissy fit about this, is that going to help him or not? In Virginia, I guess there's a lot of resentment of Northern Virginia. They're rich. They're different.
And people in Portsmouth don't ride the metro.
Right. And they don't ride the metro. But on the other hand, Northern Virginia pulls the train economically. And so things they want, like a better metro system, do wind up benefiting everyone from a tax point of view. So if a governor is seen as like, well, he's really trying to stick it to Northern Virginia, how does that play statewide?
Well, we're about to find out, because next week, the members of the General Assembly will be returning to Richmond for a one-day reconvene session when they will vote on each and every one of these budget amendments, including this one that we're talking about with metro funding. And the Democrats have the majority and the ability to reject the governor's budget amendment on metro funding. And I would imagine that's probably more likely than not.
Wait, so Brianna, you spent a lot of time on that side of the river. What do you make of it?
I am wondering, and this is the question I want to ask, like, how is this going to really affect Metro? Because doesn't Metro actually need this money right now? Like, aren't they not in a great place already when it comes to their own funding and financial situation? So I don't think they can afford to lose any type of assistance or help at this point, right?
Yeah, there's a $750 million budget gap. Maryland is kicking in $150 to help fill that gap. D.C. is kicking in $200 million to help fill that gap. The General Assembly wanted to kick in $150 million, but the governor says, no, make that $130 and also shift the burden to Northern Virginia. So yeah, you're right. There's a huge problem here with the gap. I think that was perhaps created or maybe exacerbated by the fact that fewer people are taking the metro post-pandemic, so there's less revenue. They need to fill the revenue gap, among other financial issues they've got to deal with. And on that issue, actually, one of the governor's pieces of the amendment says that he really wants to make sure that there is a financially sustainable business plan. So he wants to get a consultant involved and make sure the metro is on the right path financially.
All right. So Brianna, you write a lot about things to do around town. And for a lot of people, that includes going out to eat. The Rammies, which is the Restaurant Association of Metropolitan Washington, it's their annual awards for like best places to eat and all that. They have announced their finalists for 2024. But fun in a way that you don't have with like some of the more national awards, there's also like a public participation component.
Yes, there is a public participation component. There is a public vote. There is, in addition, some categories that are selected by an anonymous group of judges and chefs and cooks and journalists. But aside from that, the public gets to vote. And actually, we're going to kind of practice our own voting today on some of these categories, which I'm excited about. I do like to go out all the time. I eat a lot. And one of the categories, just to start off with, is New Restaurant of the Year. And I'm wondering, do either of you have any guesses or maybe one of your favorite restaurants that you think should have been a nomination for New Restaurant of the Year?
That's assuming you think me and Michael get out a lot.
I know. I'm thinking all the restaurants I know I've been to many times. And so like, I'm thinking new restaurants, there's got to be those.
Yeah, I got one for new restaurant, that Petite Cerise, the French one that's open all day.
Michael, do you have one?
Yes, I am going to pick a restaurant on King Street in Alexandria, if that's okay, which is a brand new pizza place called Emmy Squared that makes Detroit style pizza. And man, it's good.
Yes, it is really good. And also, Schaefer, you got this one because it is on the list, Petite Cerise. So, you get out more than you think. It made the list. And so did Dear Sushi, as well as Ellie Bird and Haraya and I Egg You, which is a cute breakfast spot in Capitol Hill. Okay, are you ready for the next category? It is Best Brunch, which, it's DC, it's brunch. This only makes sense. We love brunch. Doesn't matter where it is. We'll turn any restaurant, in fact, into a brunch restaurant. But I want to hear from you. What's your favorite brunch spot? Do you have a favorite brunch spot?
No. I don't believe in going out to brunch. I don't think I've gone out to brunch like since I had kids. So
is it because you're sleeping in on the weekend?
I wish.
And what about you, Michael?
I hate to be a homer here, but I'm going to go with one of my favorite Alexandria spots, which is Chadwick's, right on the waterfront. It's been around forever and a great spot for brunch. I particularly like the Huevos Rancheros.
I absolutely love Chadwick's. This is now the second place. You know, I can tell that you spend a lot of time in Alexandria, and so do I. I actually live in Alexandria and recently moved back to D.C., but I love all of those old town Alexandria restaurants are so good, including Chadwick's. It is not on the best brunch list, however. What made the nominations list is Ala, Duke's Counter, Macan, Seasons at the Four Seasons, which is a bit fancy, and The Park at 14, which is a long time brunch nightlife. You name it, spot in D.C.
I will say I'm very pro Duke's. I'm just not pro it between like, you know, 11 and 1 on weekends.
That's fair enough. I mean, their burgers are good, so you can eat burgers at any time of the day. All right. The next category is best bar. Do you have any choices for this?
My view of best bar is like the bar closest to you.
Walking distance.
Yeah.
All right, well, I'm going to go with the Waldorf Astoria, which is the famous bar where the D.C. mayor met regularly with monumental owner Ted Leonsis. And so I have to say I probably have only been there a handful of times because I don't really have not made of money the way that Ted Leonsis is. But it would be fun to go there mainly for the people watching.
Who do you think paid for those cocktails?
That's a really good question. I hope Leonsis picked up the tab.
It's the least he could do. I mean, literally, it's the least he could do.
Waldorf Astoria, that's a great bar, and it's beautiful. But it's not on the list. I'm actually surprised that didn't make the list, now that you brought it up. The ones that made the list, Bar Chinois, which is pretty popular, it's in Mount Vernon Triangle. They have a drag brunch, so obviously they need to be on this list. It's a good time. Also, Residence Cafe and Bar, which is pretty cute. They have that beautiful outdoor seating. The Green Zone made the list. Royal Sands Social Club. This does not surprise me that it's on this list either, because if you go here on a weekend after 9 p.m., it is borderline a nightclub, okay? It's usually pretty jam-packed. Also, Slash Run made the list, which makes sense because they have a lot of rock and roll concerts. It's a pretty popular music venue and also a restaurant. So all of these make sense for me. The next category is hottest sandwich spot. So this would be more like grab and go or, you know, sit down for a few minutes, more like a lunch place.
I'm going to have to jump in here and say the Colada Shop. I love the Colada Shop, and they have great sandwiches. As a Florida expat, I love Cuban food. And anytime you can get your hands on some really good Cuban food, I'm there for it. So I vote for the Colada Shop.
Do we mean hot, like in terms of trendy, or hot, like spicy? Because if it's the latter, it's going to be one of those places with like the hot chicken sandwich. And I suspect it's Roaming Rooster.
Okay. This is the first category that both of you have picked one on the list. So this tells me that you like sandwiches. Now we definitely, it means hottest sandwich shop, like not necessarily spicy, but hip. And Roaming Rooster is on the list for that. And they have a super spicy chicken sandwich. Colada Shop also made the list as well. And so did Lucky Buns, Queen Mother's, and Your Only Friend.
But so, Brianna, in your opinion, were there any places that were snubbed by the Rammies?
Yeah, you know, I enjoyed a lot of the nominations, but I was really surprised to not see Milk and Honey on the list. Have you all been there before?
Mm-mm.
Okay, Milk and Honey is a New Orleans-inspired, Southern, Black-owned restaurant, and they have quite a bit of locations throughout the DMV area. They recently opened one at the Wharf. They just opened a new location, maybe like 3 weeks or so ago in Fort Washington, Maryland. And it's really, really good. I was surprised to not see it on Best Brunch Spot because they serve breakfast and brunch all day long. I mean, they have dishes like fried salmon and fried deviled eggs. And if you can fry an egg and make it taste good, then I think it should be on the list.
All right. So before we wrap, how do people go about voting?
Yeah. So if you want to submit your vote, which just to note, the actual winners are going to be announced in July. So you have some time before you actually find out who wins. But if you want to submit a public vote, the voting opened up Tuesday, April 9th, and it is going to close Wednesday, May 31st at 5 p.m. You can vote by going to NBCWashington.com/Grammys.
Hey, thank you so much, Brianna, and thanks for being here.
Thanks. Happy to be here anytime.
And awesome to see you too, Michael Pope.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
And that is all for today here on CityCast DC. Our interim executive producers are Julia Caron and Kayla Cote-Stemmerman. Kayla also writes our super informative and fun newsletter. It's called Hey DC. Our interim producer is Ash Durbin. We got help this week from Dylan Brogan, Elizabeth Kama, Adrian Gonzalez, and Natalia Aldana. Our hosts are Bridget Todd and me, Michael Schaefer from Politico. Music is by Alex Roldan. If you enjoyed the show, why not tell a friend, rate the show, leave us a review, and subscribe to our morning newsletter. We'll be back Monday morning with more news from around the city. Bye.
Good segue.
I aim to please, my friend.